Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality they see below the surface.
Yeah, that's what we do. Episode number 82. I almost said 81, but that was Shower.
I'm not going back in time. I'm going to move forward.
Excellent. 82. We're going to talk about The Rosie Project by Graham Simsion. I hope that I've pronounced that correctly. I promised myself I would figure that out before the podcast and then didn't. So I apologize.
I think he'll manage because I've noticed he's been favoriting any tweets or any Goodreads notes about it.
Yeah, yeah.
He seems enthusiastic and on board.
Yeah, there was a description of the author that said he was an IT professional. So I said, well, that's interesting. So I looked him up on Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. And the description of him is this. Graham C. Simsion is a New Zealand-born Australian author, screenwriter, playwright, and data modeler.
Hmm.
So, interesting.
Yeah, that takes the creative and the analytical sides and really mashes them together, doesn't
it? Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Very nice. He says, let's see, in 2006, as a PhD candidate at the University of Melbourne, he conducted the largest published study of data modeling practitioners to address the question, is data modeling better characterized as description or design?
Okay, first, just for anybody out there who doesn't hear, not me, I know all about it. What is data modeling?
Well, data modeling would be like when you have large databases. You know, you need to structure those databases. I sure hope I'm getting this correct because this is what I think it is, but you have to structure those databases in a certain way that the data is retrievable. Right. And as you get huge ones, there's tables upon tables upon tables upon tables. Okay. So modeling the entire data system has an art to it that,
okay. Oh yeah. That's because it's like looking at survey information, questionnaires possibly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Results.
It's like there's a website called 538, which is, what is that guy? Nate Silver. People who love data would love this website. Yeah. It's 538 spelled out FIVE, the word 30 and the word 8.com.
Okay.
And Nate Silver is the one who does, the predictions of who's going to win elections. And he was so right in the last one that he got famous.
Oh yeah. Except for people like me who don't even know what data modeling is. I'm sure this guy is super famous.
Right. Right.
I apologize for not knowing who you are, Nate Silver, and data modeling.
Right. So they do data on all kinds of stuff on that site. But one of the last things I noticed, they said, well, here's the raw data. Tell us what you guys do with it. So, you know, it's interesting that people are starting to play with data that way. You know, you can take a whole piece of data, you know, that says this is an opinion poll on this certain thing. And you can say, well, Catholics believe this in the country and Protestants believe that and minorities believe this or whatever. And so
we can see how important data modeling is because of how often it's gotten without any nuance at all.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, so that would make a lot of sense in terms of this book, because essentially it's about Don Tillman, who is 39. He's a professor of genetics at a New Zealand college. And I think the back of the book describes him as somebody who's got high functioning Asperger syndrome, but he himself, as he mentions when he's been reading about it, doesn't realize. A lot of the times these people don't realize it, he mentions. And but he's obviously got a real problem fitting into society. And we see it all from his point of view. So you see how he's got his whole day broken down into these very rigid timetables of what he's going to do and when. He's got a hugely he follows all the rules, you know, like for health and everything. he is obviously very awkward talking to people, but at one point he becomes friends with this elderly lady at his apartment complex. And over the course of time, she finally says, "I think you'd make somebody a wonderful husband." And he's like, "Oh, wait, I don't think you understand my romantic history. I've given up on that idea forever." And she insists that, no, no, there's somebody for everyone. And this makes him start thinking. And then he puts it together with the idea of, hey, if I did a questionnaire, I could find somebody who matches up with me. And this begins his wife project, as he calls it. And there are several projects that we see labeled this way throughout the book. But I can't describe how funny this book is.
Oh, yeah.
Without being condescending at all, mm-hmm. I feel, to this awkward personality type. In fact, one of the things I loved about it is that it lets you see inside the head of somebody who just perceives the world so differently. And that's part of the comic element, is you could see from the other side what's happening. And he'll, like, you know, somebody's asking him out for coffee and they put their hand on his, or for a drink, and they put their hand on his shoulder. And he's like, definitely inappropriate contact. If I'd have done that to her, I would have been called up before the college board. But no, she can do it and nobody does anything. And she's like, well, so you want to get a drink and we could talk about this? And he's like, no, I have to go home. I have a lot of things to do, because he's going to start the wife project. And you're like, right there, you could have had a date. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
So.
Yeah, that's too funny.
I don't think I described it very well, but that gives you just a touch of the way humor is used in this.
Yeah, yeah. And the wife project questionnaire. I just have a line here that's highlighted. It says, and he retrieved, I retrieved the wife project folder, pulling out Jean's copy of the draft. I had pruned it to 16 double-sided pages. And he's giving this questionnaire to people, and people are filling it out.
I know.
Yeah.
No,
it's like, well, you know, just imagine, you know, what kind of person would take the time to fill it out in the first place?
Well, that was the thing. Well, and the thing I loved is he has two friends. They're a husband and wife. And the husband is a psychologist, and the wife might also be. I can't remember. But she's at least a sensible woman who, you know, mostly has his interest at heart. And she's looking at it going, huh, let me guess, and let's see if I have this quoted, where she's commenting on the questionnaire. It says, Claudia and Jean were reading. Claudia said, for an appointment, I'm guessing B, a little early. This was patently incorrect, demonstrating that even Claudia, who was a good friend, would be unsuitable as a partner. The correct answer, I said, is C, on time. Habitual earliness is cumulatively a major waste of time. I'd allow a little early, said Claudia. She might be trying hard. That's not a bad thing. An interesting point. I made a note to consider it, but pointed out that D, a little late, and E, very late, were definitely unacceptable. But I love that he's like, oh, even she would be unsuitable based on one answer.
Yeah, yeah. And he has 16 pages of those answers. He's always he's always rethinking it, you know, like, oh, maybe I should be more lenient on this answer. Or that answer throughout the whole book. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think the thing that's really interesting is he does go on a date fairly early, or he talks about a date at one point where he bases his entire decision on when this girl says she does like apricot ice cream.
Oh, yeah.
And if they don't have apricot ice cream, she just doesn't care for any. And he's like, well, anybody knows that the human taste buds are so chilled that you can't really taste the different flavors of ice cream at that point. And I'm just like, but you've eaten ice cream, right? You know that ice cream is different, correct? I mean, he's not able to really always apply personal experience very well to the data that he's basing everything on. And he's so based in science because it's the only thing he really can understand. He doesn't understand people at all.
Right, right. And the right at the end of the part that you just read, where, you know, very late is definitely unacceptable. There's a line where he says, this was exactly the sort of input I was looking for. Subtle nuances of language that I am not conscious of.
Right.
So he's aware that he does not get this stuff. You know, someone can be talking to him and he won't be able to read what the emotion or the motive behind the sentence is, and he'll take a sentence very literally, or, you know, without the meaning of it.
Yeah, like at one point he's at a cocktail party, and you know, this does play out in a lot of ways like a romantic comedy. And I don't mean to make it sound off-putting, because if somebody had told me that, I'm not sure if I would have wanted to pick the book up, but only in the best way. Mm-hmm. And he's, for circumstances, he's waiting tables and taking drink orders. And because of his very stiff manner and because he's a waiter, somebody has been picking on him. And the woman with him says, "Not everybody has your number of synapses and you need to back off of it," or whatever. And he says, "I understood that Jenny had been trying to tell Rod discreetly that I was unintelligent, presumably because of my waiter role. She had used a neat social trick, which I noted for future use, but had made a factual error which Rod had not corrected. Perhaps one day he or she would make a clinical or research mistake as the result of this misunderstanding," because they're all doctors and scientists. "Before I returned to the bar, I spoke to them again. There is no experimental evidence of a correlation between synapse numbers and intelligence within primate levels. I recommend reading Williams and Harrop, Annual Review of Neuroscience. I hoped this would be helpful." And you can just imagine their stunned faces.
Oh, that was the best scene. I mean, that whole thing.
I loved that. Yeah. Well, there were so many great scenes. And this is where the reason it plays out like a romantic comedy is that at one point, Rosie comes into Don's orbit in terms of he thinks that she's answered the questionnaire.
Mm-hmm.
And he proceeds as if, you know, so has her over for dinner and all this stuff.
Yeah, he thinks that Gene has sent her, his friend Gene.
Right.
He thought his friend Gene had sent her as a candidate.
Right.
When that's not why she was there at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so what happens is she's got a big problem in her life, and he, because of his genetics thing, is going to help her with this. And so this brings them into continued contact. But Rosie, he keeps also comparing the things that she says and does against his questionnaire. He's like, "See, once again, we can only be friends because of this." She's always late. She smokes. She this and that. Mm-hmm. And of course, as the reader, you see where it's going. But it's so... It's not as obvious as it seems like it could be, because you can't trust that Don's going to not just screw it up because he just doesn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think I read at the end of the book, a little question and answer thing with the author, maybe, where he wrote it originally as a screenplay and then was encouraged to turn it into a book. And maybe he rewrote it 5 times or 7 times, and it took a number of years to do it.
Wow.
And I think that's testified to by the fact that this is a hilarious book. I can describe it to especially my women friends as a romantic comedy, and they all get interested.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's got this layer of helping you see inside that completely different way of thinking. And you love Don, not from the beginning, but you grow to love Don and you really empathize with him. You really want him to have everything work out. And they make a number of insights about just human behavior on the way.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. You know, I was really into this book from the very first paragraph. I mean, I just kept loving getting back to it. I flew through it. I thought it was just excellent. And I would describe it as a romantic comedy. If this was a movie, that's exactly the mm-hmm. genre it would end up in.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there is a lot to it. And Don Tillman... He is a very lovable guy, you know, when you're inside his head, because the whole thing's from his point of view mm-hmm. in first person. And you start to, he's always got good motives. He's not, even if he's insulting someone by accident, or, you know, he'll tell them something and there it'll be insulting to that person, but it's just this fact. You know that his motive is right. You know, what he's trying to do, just like you said there, you know, in that one scene where he's trying to help this possible future error in research by suggesting this thing, which could have been insulting to the person who was, you know, getting that information.
Right, exactly. It might look like he's just trying to one-up
him. Right. He's like, you know, "I am super smart and here's why," you know, and all this. But it was done without any of those emotions, none of that. Mm-hmm. You know, "I have to make sure this person knows who I am." It wasn't mm-hmm. that. it was just like, this person is going to make a mistake. So I've got to tell them that.
Yeah. And he also understands best how to do things based on computer terminology a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So later on when he's a huge hit at this cocktail party, by the way, everybody just loves him and they all want him to take their drink orders and all this stuff. Cause he does things like, oh, I was going to have to help with this cocktail thing. So I memorized the cocktail book completely.
Yep.
You know, and then he remembers it. He's got this fabulous memory that he's, you know, worked to enhance. And so at one point, somebody says, well, is there a cocktail with Galliano and tequila? They all quieted. This sort of question had become common during dinner. They seemed impressed with my response. And then he says, well, I took a minute to think. And the guy calls out, well, don't worry. He says, I'm re-indexing my internal database, I said, to explain the delay. It took a few moments.
I love it.
And then he says the drink, and they all roar with applause. One of each, the guy says.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
I've got some here that also describes exactly what you're saying. It's another highlight. It says, occasionally an emotion can be enjoyed. The gratitude I felt for my sister, who visited me even during the bad times. The primitive feeling of well-being after a glass of wine. But we need to be vigilant that emotions do not cripple us. I diagnose brain overload and set up a spreadsheet to analyze the situation.
Yeah.
And then he says, I began by listing the recent disturbances to my schedule. And I do that. meaning when I start to feel like things are getting out of control, which is he's describing like brain overload, I make a list. I sit down and I go, okay, this is blah, 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 blah. And then with a list, it helps me cope that, okay, now I can have this and I can go through it and I can see it disappearing. And,
oh my gosh.
You know, so I do that all the time. I make lists.
Oh no, stop it. Stop it. I make little schedules of how my day, you know, I'm like, this is out of control. Not maybe my emotions, but I'm like, I just can't get anything done. Why is this? And so I'll sit down and go, okay, so if I spend an hour on this, half an hour on that, okay. And I'm not continually redoing them, but I come back to them every so often just to try and get a visual look at what am I doing?
Yeah. Yeah.
I have to say that was part of, I've read this book twice now and the second time was just as enjoyable as the first. I read through it in a flash. I listened to the audio version a lot and it was really good.
Cool.
The guy does That's a good. New Zealand. I assume it's a New Zealand accent. I mean, to me, I'm sorry. The Concords would hate me, but they're the same kind of accent. But the narrator will do a different accent when he encounters someone who's French or something. The American accent, I always admire people who can really do a good one because his is not quite there, but it's close enough that you know what he's going for. And it is really well done. And anyway, though, shoot, I lost my train of thought.
You were talking about how you do some of this stuff in the second. Yeah.
In each case, about halfway through the book, I started really worrying that I was like Don Tillman. I really was invested in him and I had absorbed so much of his way of thinking. I was like, oh my gosh, I do this, I do that, I do this. And then I'd go, no, no, no. Everyone has quirks. That's okay.
Oh, that's great.
I do understand emotions and social cues and I don't have to do this just in order to feel like I can live because everybody around me is so weird. And that's poor Don's problem. He doesn't understand anyone, but he knows that he's making mistakes all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he has this rigid schedule so that he can, in a sense, relax within it.
Because that's a really great point, you know, because that's one of the things that's, such a criticism of religion is
that's this, right.
These rules that are imposed on people, you know, and how stifling it is and how it actually, you know, they feel that it has the opposite effect of what it actually has, which is, like you said, it's the freedom within that is very freeing. There's a freedom that you experience through the religious process, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. But when you said that, it just made me think of that.
No, that's really a good point. And I was just reading a quote from G.K. Chesterton the other day. I've been reading through my old quote journals, and he was saying something about, he goes, what people don't understand about the Ten Commandments is that it shows how open religion is. He says, they don't it's so much easier to list the things that you can't do than the things you can. There are only 10 things you're not allowed to do, or that, you know, you have to cover.
And those really are pretty good rules too.
Yeah. Yeah, as rules for life.
Yeah. Well, they help us all live together, you know?
Yeah. And I can see where non-religious people especially would go, well, yeah, but that there's no God before me. And, you must, what is it? I guess the other one's observe the Sabbath, but that's part of the no God before you. But anyway, it's the whole thing of, even if you don't believe in God, I would say, if you stop and think about it the way Don would, you do believe in something. Mm-hmm. You believe in science, or you believe in, you know, there's a better way to do things than now, like for government, there's some ideal, which means that you have something else that you're relying on. What happens when that lets you down? Then, and I think that's where, even with religion, you know, like people who belong especially to a specific religion, what happens when that lets you down? For Catholics, like, look at the sex scandals.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where you have to really think long and hard and go, these are people. This was so wrong. This institution in these ways got this so wrong. The emphasis wasn't there. That's not God.
Yeah.
And that's where you look at, like, say, if you have faith in science, and that's that book I was mentioning that I reviewed called Why Science Does Not Disprove God. And the guy who wrote it is an atheist. He's just sick of people hijacking science for their own purposes, for their own agendas. He's like, could we have some facts here, please? That's all I can.
That's, you know, it's nice. Some things have to be said by a certain side of an argument. And that's one of those things that if people on that side of the argument would stand up and say, you know, this is ridiculous, because it doesn't prove anything what we're saying.
Right.
It's just that we have a position and, you know, science and religion they're not opposites. They are not, they don't cancel each other out. They're not mutually exclusive. So,
and that's, he even says that,
yeah,
you know, in there, he's like, both things are good and you can have both things. He never says what he believes. Somebody I know heard him on an interview where they were saying, well, what do you believe? And he's like, oh, I'm an atheist, but I don't have to have that proven through science. Or if you're going to prove it, no one's done it yet, because that's probably impossible to prove, but you have to have facts and look at them objectively.
Right.
And that's what he objects to, is, you know, people like Richard Dawkins who are just, they have an agenda.
Yeah. He's got a thing that, yeah. And he'll argue even some of his arguments that make no sense at all. It's because it feeds that worldview. He's like, well, I'm going to grab onto that until I realize it doesn't make any sense, you know, and that point may be a while. And then he'll say, okay, well, I'll move on to the next one. It doesn't change his mind in any way. It's just like, okay, well, maybe that one. So,
well, he's just as bad at that point as any flat earther or, you know, I mean, it's
all
like
sides, all sides of everything. People that are, you know, I don't know, extreme about something.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're presented with facts and that doesn't make any difference, that's difficult.
Yeah, exactly. Because the way, and I know we've said this before, but why not say it again? I mean, the way Catholics, the church looks at it, is that science is discovering truth, and truth with a capital T, ultimate truth, is God. So anything you're discovering shows you another facet of God. And in fact, that I was thinking of that when at one point Don and Rosie are in New York, and they're at the Museum of Natural History, he's like, at one point he says, the three best days of my life, the first day I went to the Museum of Natural History, the second day I went to the Museum of Natural History, and the third day I went to the Museum of Natural History. I mean, this is the best place on earth. And he organizes a tour for Rosie, and he, you know, he's had to severely edit it. He wanted to spend 4 days showing it to her.
Yeah.
He didn't have that much time. And I think, let's see here, dang it. But there's one point where, after looking at the tour of, basically it's the history of the universe as everybody can put it together in that museum.
Yeah, I've got that up. It's page 216 on the ebook.
Okay. Dang it, that's so
You could look up Cosmic Pathway is the name of the spiral ramp. That would send you there too.
Okay. Well, or you could read it.
Okay. Which part about this? Which part would you like?
Because I'm terrible at the Kindle, and I'm sorry, everyone. This is all on the Kindle. Well, it's the part where he's talking about them looking. Basically, they're looking at. They have a long painted strip, I think, that shows here's the beginning of the universe as we know it, and here's our little bit in history.
Right.
And he says most people look at that and they go, wow, I feel so insignificant. Wow, we're not very important. And he said, I never felt that way.
Yeah. Okay, I can read that paragraph.
Yeah.
Okay, then we went up in the elevator and joined the Heilbrunn Cosmic Pathway, a 110-meter spiral ramp representing a timeline from the Big Bang to the present. It is just pictures and photos and occasional rocks and fossils on the wall, and I didn't even need to look at them because I know the story, which I related as accurately and as dramatically as I could, putting all that we had seen during the day into context. As we walked down and around until we reached the ground level and tiny vertical hairline, and the tiny vertical hairline representing all of recorded human history. It was almost closing time now, and we were the only people standing there. On other occasions, I have listened to people's reactions as they reach the end. Makes you feel a bit unimportant, doesn't it, they say. I suppose that is one way of looking at it. How the age of the universe somehow diminishes our lives or the events of history or Joe DiMaggio's streak. But Rosie's response was a verbal version of mine. Wow, she said very quietly, looking back at the vastness of it all. Then, in this vanishingly small moment in the history of the universe, she took my hand and held it all the way to the subway.
Oh, just a minute, I have tears in my eyes. That was great. You can see the romantic comedy right there, but it was that same moment of, I love the way he says, in that vanishingly important moment in history, you know, right. Because the most important thing at that moment was that she actually held his hand.
Yeah, exactly.
And that had never happened. And so I looked at that and thought he did, without evoking any of the stuff that we're talking about, but he did that beautiful job of what I have come to feel. That, you know, somebody like Richard Dawkins would tell me is stupid, I guess. But I look at the idea that, especially Peter Kreeft talks about a lot, is that the universe was created for humans. And people will say, well, this makes you feel pretty important, doesn't it? And it's like, no, I don't think you understand. I think our responsibility is then very huge. If that's why the universe is here, is for us to all become saints and live our lives to the ultimate. How much does God love us?
Wow.
What is our deep responsibility back? And it's things like, how do you connect with other people, holding their hands, caring about them, taking them soup when they've been sick to show them you love them and give them a meal? I mean, that's our little ripple of our vanishingly important part. But to compare what we're going through here to this long period of time and say that makes us unimportant. Well, it doesn't. That's a false judging of values or something.
Yeah. And I think I've heard Kreeft say that in this vast time that the universe has been in existence, there's still only one you.
Right.
You're the only one.
Right.
You know, in everything that's ever happened, you're the only one and you're here right now. You know, that's incredible.
Yeah, and that's Don's story.
Yeah, it
is. He's the only one like him, and of course we know that's not the case. Rosie's unique, Jean is unique, Claudia is unique. All these people are completely unique, and that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And God loves each one of us as if we were the only one of us. I mean, the only person on earth. We get, because he is God and he is infinite and he is not like anything we can imagine, each of us gets the full force of his love and attention. Not meaning that he's helping us out like by, you know, making the traffic stop for me. That's right. Not what I mean by attention, but because he wants each of us to be as happy. We're put here to be happy, meaning live our potential.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I've really gotten off track.
No, it's incredible. It's just, well, it's incredible to think about it. The which book?
called Seven Glorious Days that I think I've mentioned.
Oh, yes, 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 right.
Someday I want us to read that. And that's also by a scientist who is a believer, but he's just talking about the creation of the universe, and then he winds up with us too. And it kind of has that same feel of looking at overall the timing of things and how they happened. And he's like, each of these things happened kind of as fast as it possibly could within this matrix to get to the next step, to get us here, essentially.
Right.
It's a really interesting book, and I'd love to have somebody who's a scientist read it and tell me if, you know, because I can't judge if he's right or wrong on that kind of thing. It seems to make sense the way he argues it.
Okay.
But
yeah, I actually own it on ebook. I've got to read it. I haven't read it yet.
Yeah,
but I bought it. And I was like, I've got to read this, but it's on the list.
Well, I think I've mentioned it before because somebody I worked with took it and lent it to her biology teacher, who had a lot of questions about. She was struggling with the idea of God and the idea of science and them being compatible. And I said, let me know. I would love to know, at least on the sections that she knows about, does he get stuff wrong? Is he tweaking it? You know, I don't want to read something that's been tweaked like that. And that person didn't have those questions. They had other questions it generated. And I said, the author's email is very, you know, you can write to him. And she went, I never thought of that. And I was like, I think he welcome answering these things. He wrote a book.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's off track.
No, it's fascinating.
The book.
There was an incident, you know, and Don Tillman always calls things incidents, you know, the incident of the blah, the incident of this, the flounder incident, which kind of ties into what you're saying. He was teaching a class, and there was a creationist in the class who raised, I don't recall if it was a he or she, raised her hand and said, well, this is all, you know, you've got to take creation into account and all this stuff. And, you know, Tillman was pretty blunt. And anyway, he let it go in the class, but it was always bothering him. And then he went to, didn't he grab a fish from
a restaurant,
right? That was eaten, right? And he said, can I have that?
The head was on.
Excuse me. Can I have that? So he takes it. Yeah, the head was on. And then he embarrassed this person in front of other students and gave this person this flounder and said, you know, it evolved this way and look at how its eyes were. And it doesn't that seem to be a mistake. And if this is a mistake, then your whole argument falls apart.
I love the way you said, you know, evolution doesn't tidy up. It just moved the eye around enough to see above, since flounders have both eyes on one side, because it doesn't have to be symmetrical. Done. Here you go.
Right, right, exactly.
But he felt he was just giving him some basic information.
Yeah, and he wasn't doing it to be mean. But then later on, I highlighted this thing where he was questioning himself. Had the flounder demonstration been an instance of bullying as heinous as the one committed by my religious education teacher, even though I was right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. And what do you remember? What was the religious education teacher incident? Trying to recall. That was in his past. Shoot, I don't remember it specifically, but
I don't know if he mentioned specifically. I think he just said that he was 11 and he was trying to bring up scientific stuff, and then he just got smacked down in front of the Sunday school class. And, of course, he was an awkward kid, and it sounds like this teacher was awful. Which happens.
Right. Yeah, I'm just reading this paragraph right before it. See, and what if my teacher had been... See, now as I walked into the dean's office, another thought occurred to me. What if my teacher had been a brilliant theologian, equipped with 2,000 years of well-articulated Christian thinking? She would have had more compelling arguments than an 11-year-old. Would I have then been satisfied? I suspect not. As a scientist with an allegiance to scientific thinking, I would have had a deep-seated feeling that I was being, as Rosie would say, BS'd.
Yeah.
Was that how a faith healer had felt? Interesting thoughts.
Yeah, because by that time of the book, he suddenly had so many experiences that are outside of his normal range because of being around Rosie. And her project is she wants to find out who her biological father is. And
the father project.
And since he has access to the school's genetic testing equipment, he embarks on this quest to help her, and it involves testing a large number of people for reasons that we won't go into right now. But in the course of that, that's where he has to go way outside his comfort level.
Yeah, his schedule has been obliterated.
Oh,
you know, so he's gone from, I remember an incident early in the book where he exercises and he figures it's going to take him this long. And in order to fit something else in, he skipped the shower and ran straight to wherever he was going. So he was a sweaty mess. And but he didn't consider that, you know, that's going to be pretty awkward for everybody.
Yeah.
So he went from that to having no schedule whatsoever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because when they're in New York and they have 4 days between appointments, and Rosie says, give me 2 days. And so while she goes upstairs and he has to face the fact that he's only going to get 2 days at the museum, she comes back down. And he says, OK, I've done it. I've rebooted my brain. I will just accept what you do. And he has, you know, a blast. And it's between that and having to figure out, every so often it will surface where he's like, why am I helping her? Well, I have time. I'll push the wife project to one side. I'm not getting a lot of responses to questionnaires. I'll put the time in. I'll just fill my time with the father project.
Yep.
And of course, we're all like, Don, come on, man. But in a sense, it's just heightening that obliviousness that all of us feel at times, where you suddenly stop and almost have that room whirling around you feeling of what? As reality does kind of readjust and your brain takes in everything.
Yeah, and that's a key thing, you know, attitude. You know, what you're clinging on to, you know, we go through that every Lent. You know, that's what they tell us mm-hmm. every Lent. You know, whatever it is that you're holding on to, let it go. But that's what they talk about in Lent, is that very thing. And you know, Don experiences that right here where he lets it go mm-hmm. and it allows him to progress.
Well, and I guess speaking of the Lenten thing, because people look at that from the outside and say, you're just torturing yourself. You know, why would you do that? And it's the idea of you're casting out some things that you don't want and aren't good for you anyway, probably, at least for a little while, not permanently, but you're opening up space.
Mm-hmm.
It's like cleaning out a closet in a way. And by him allowing all those holes to be punched in his schedule, it's opening up space for something new. Because you really do see the contrast between the beginning when Rosie comes over for dinner and she says, oh, you really like Bach. And he's like, well, I read a book by so-and-so, and I really couldn't, I don't listen anymore. He was trying to listen to it note by note to get the analysis that the author had gotten.
Yeah, yeah.
And she takes his whiteboard and puts it out on his little patio so that they can look at the city lights while they eat. And he's like, whoa, this isn't a table. What? And she says, well, don't you ever sit out here and just look at it? And he says, well, it's always the same. I've seen it once. And she says, no, it always changes. And he looks and he goes, no, it's just the same. She says, no, lights go off and on, you know. Mm. So he has no pictures on the wall, because once you've seen the picture, you've analyzed it and taken it in. You don't need to see it again. I can see them in the museum when they come by.
Uh-huh.
You know, his life is lived completely by what he's read in science books. And he's had nobody to come into his life and give him practical other ways to live, at least that he could accept. I just feel for his parents. I know he had trouble. And I can only imagine growing up in a tiny town in New Zealand and dealing with, you know, your weird child. You love them, but how do you help them cope? And maybe you don't have the skills yourself to help them cope.
Yeah, yeah. That's all true.
That's it. I got nothing else.
But yeah, that's cool. You know, I hadn't thought of those things.
Oh.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Yay. I can't lie. I was reading this book and there was a specific person in my immediate family, well, not immediate, in my extended family who I was like, here we go.
Oh, wow.
You know?
That's funny. You know, I know bits and pieces of the people in here, you know, mm-hmm. in others.
Mm-hmm.
I could not help. I don't know if you watch Big Bang Theory.
No, no,
but
I don't.
I could not help but internally cast Jim Parsons in this role which, you know, I hope that when Big Bang Theory is over, I hope that he can, you know, do roles other than this type of person.
Yeah.
But yeah. But I couldn't help it. You know, he fit perfectly.
Well, Hannah hasn't read it, even though I've given her the book. Uh-huh. But she hasn't read it. But she does, for other people, the shorthand is Abed and Love from Community.
Oh, yeah. Why not?
Yeah. It's the same kind of very they're not dysfunctional because they found a way to cope.
Uh-huh.
But the way that they cope is so misunderstood by other people.
Yeah, yeah.
Community kind of shows that too, how being around them and he influences the group. They influence him and kind of loosens things up.
Right. Fascinating.
Yeah. Well, and you can see, although not as clearly at all, but you can see Rosie's dilemma. She's becoming more and more attracted to him. It's very obvious, but inevitably something happens, his reactions, that just shows her how different he is.
Uh-huh.
You know, and it turns off the mood or whatever. And I did love the thing on the plane where, because he is, I have to say, one of the most lovable things about him is he's ruthlessly honest.
Yeah, yeah. And I think I know what you're about to say.
Thing where they, you know, he's like, why did I deliberately sabotage our one romantic encounter?
Yeah, yeah.
I know I sabotaged it. Why did I do that?
Yeah.
And it takes him hours to think it through, but he thinks it through and figures it out.
Yeah.
And in a way that most of us would never do. And I had to honor him for that. He kept going to the logical conclusion of the facts. But that's also what helps him figure out that in the end that he can love, because she really wants him, but she's like, but you can't feel love. And he goes, well, not the way you do. I can't cry at romantic movies and this and that.
Yeah. And that that was a tough, brutally honest part. You know, I've got that highlighted. He said, I nodded. I knew what the problem was. The fundamental, insurmountable problem of who I was.
Mm-hmm.
I had pushed it to the back of my mind since it had surfaced in the fight with Phil. Rosie didn't need to explain, but she did. And then she goes on to say, you know, that's inside you. You can't fake. Sorry, start again. You can behave perfectly. But if the feeling's not there inside, God, I feel so unreasonable. And then, you know, she really wants it. But Dawn, you don't feel love, do you? She says. And then, you know, he's really analytical about it. I had cried no tears for Meg Ryan or Meryl Streep or Deborah Kerr or Vivien Leigh or Julia Roberts. I could not lie about so important a matter. According to your definition, no, he says. Tough, you know.
Well, yeah, and he has changed himself into, he's watched all these romantic movies. And of course, later on, he does that same analytical thing. But at that point, he's going by that particular definition. And he says, I thought my behavior would make you happy. And instead, it's made you sad. Because he's changed himself into look like Gregory Peck and all these various things. And she says, I'm upset because you can't love me, okay? This was worse. She wanted me to love her. And I was incapable. What a devastating, I mean, I just, you know, your heart breaks. That's truly a moment of death, as you would say in the movies.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing that I really loved is he's miserable and he gets out his tequila bottle and all these various things. But in his way, he starts working the problem. And when he's working the problem is when he realizes how his life has been changed. And it's not in that way that we would all realize it, but he realizes that his questionnaire was nothing other than a matchmaker would have done in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, it's shown that I could have a mate. You know, I might not love them the same way as Rosie, but, or as Rosie loves, but, mm-hmm. you know, all these various things in his life that he's reevaluating how he thinks of himself because it's shown him a new side of himself. And he said, oh, well, I thought this, but this isn't really true. I thought this, but this isn't really true. It's this. It's redefined. And that's when he says, an inability or reduced ability to empathize is not the same as an inability to love. Love is a powerful feeling for another person, often defying logic. This is one of his lists. 2004, Rosie had failed numerous criteria on the Wife Project, including the critical smoking question. My feelings for her could not be explained by logic. I did not care about Meryl Streep, but I was in love with Rosie.
Hooray, Dawn, go get her.
I know. Go, go, go. Well, and then at the end, he's like, but I have, and she's like, oh, you've changed your mind. And he goes, no, but I haven't. That's the point. I want to spend my life with you, even though it's totally irrational. And you have short earlobes. I mean, because he continually comes back to the science. Socially and genetically, there's no reason for me to be attracted to you. The only logical conclusion is that I must be in love with you.
Wow.
You know, and you're just like, oh, wow. Because he presents it in a completely different way. And I just, you know, you're just like, yes.
Yeah. I love it. Have you, the last paragraph.
Yeah.
Would you read that one?
Oh, you want me to?
Okay. I do. Yeah. Starting with ultimately.
Yeah, that's what I've got. Ultimately, the entire father problem was caused by Gene. He almost certainly taught the medical students an oversimplified model of the inheritance of common traits. If Rosie's mother had known that eye color was not a reliable indicator of paternity and organized a DNA test to confirm her suspicions, there would have been no father project, no great cocktail night, no New York adventure, no reformed Don project, and no Rosie project. Had it not been for this unscheduled series of events, her daughter and I would not have fallen in love, and I would still be eating lobster every Tuesday night. Incredible.
I like that last incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, that's, I mean, and that whole thing, you know, how our lives are so dependent on other people and the decisions that we make affect others and the decisions others make affect us. And then you put God into that mix. Well, God, you know, is the original mixer, right? So
right.
It's, you know, this is my view of the world right there in a paragraph, you know, how mm-hmm. everybody's all intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, and it's that huge chain of coincidence that is, in fact, not a coincidence.
Uh-huh.
It's what I can't remember her name, but the elderly neighbor said, there's someone for everyone. Mm-hmm. It just might not be easy to find them.
Right.
And I firmly believe that. Now, we might find our, you know, true loves, and they might have been messed up by other people before we got there.
Yep.
They might not be perfect.
Sure.
And we might not be perfect. Okay.
Well, we are certainly not.
Not perfect. Okay. No one's going to be perfect. Mm-hmm. But it's that thing of, like you say, there's God in the mix there.
Mm-hmm.
It's really kind of an unbelievably amazing thing.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And it's something to look back. You know, I have Father Martin, who we're going to talk about next week, mm-hmm. Has said, you know, one of the prayer things that he does every now and then, he throws out on Twitter is, you know, look at your day. Where was God in your day today?
Mm-hmm.
And doing that every night and looking back. And sometimes it's surprising when you take the time to stop and look and you're like, wow, you know, that was really something. And I missed it at that moment. I went right by it, but wasn't that something?
Right. Well, that's a good question, because that's such a, I've never heard such a good summing up of the Jesuit self-examine, I think they call it,
uh-huh.
where at the end of the day, they stop and they go, what could I have done better? What went really well? Where did I shine? You know, kind of thing. And of course, you're always supposed to think about God. So I like that. Where was God in your day?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to start. I'm writing that down.
Yeah. Father Martin. Father James.
Yeah.
Martin. Yep. He's great to follow on Twitter. He does lots of good stuff on there.
Oh, fine.
Oh, that doesn't mean you have Twitter. To join Twitter. I'm just throwing it out for any Twitter people who already like it.
Yeah. Oh, now you just make me feel like I'm missing something. Out of here.
Well, I'm missing all of Facebook, so.
Well,
Twitter's the only one I've kept out of everything that I ever got involved in. Twitter, yeah. I kept.
Yeah.
I enjoy it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I, yeah. Well, Facebook, I have so severely limited who I follow or see or anything.
Sure.
But anyway, yeah, so, and because nowhere in this is, you know, it, there's no hint of the religious, except when he himself is talking about how do people communicate with each other. And he's talking about people who communicate because not well, because they have such different worldviews or ways of looking at things. And so when Don, that part that you mentioned where Don's talking about, you know, his nickname for him was Faith Healer. When he nicknamed him Faith Healer, but he was dealing with this whole idea of religion versus science. That's not the only thing he's reevaluating. He's realizing that Dean has all these things she's trying to balance. All these people he's come into conflict with are trying to fix things for themselves or manage the world in a way that he is also. His is just more out there on the surface. He's not buffered by the little social conventions, the way we all understand each other. You know, Gene's got his problem with he wants to sleep with a woman from every nationality or every country in the world because he has an open marriage, which is clearly the worst idea in the world. And it's making his wife so angry, even though she agreed to it. And it shows Don's depth in understanding increasing as he gets more experience with social stuff, because he finally says, oh, wait. At first, he's like, oh, this is fine. Everybody's fine. They all agree. And genetically, it works, blah, blah, blah. Well, by the end, he's going, cut it out. You're being an idiot. You're going to lose a wife.
Yep. And then he understands that in himself. And that was a great moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. In his lists.
I know. I love those lists. Well, yeah. Yeah, because the whole book, I mean, I guess that's the essence of a really good romantic comedy, is we recognize ourselves in it, and we all want love. We all want to meet that person who understands us better than anyone else.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and it takes work, and it takes practice, and learning to look at yourself in different ways, and being humble, which Don is pretty humble.
Yeah, he is. But, yeah. So, yeah, and the whole thing is just so funny. I mean, there's just so many things, and it's not tragic funny, you know.
No.
Which, I mean, this author could have certainly gone there.
No.
But it was just really terrific, really well done.
I'm glad, because I haven't looked through the Goodreads reviews, but I was curious about what a guy would think, because it would be easy to label this as a chick book, but I think because it's from Don's point of view and he's so different.
Mm-hmm.
It opens it up.
Yeah, very, very good.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
I doubt I would have ever picked it up, another one, but I loved it. Just really loved it.
Have I shared the story of why I read it?
No.
Okay. I had to be forced to read it by my mother, who said, you've got to read this book. And I said, oh, okay. And I get out my list, which when I'm talking to her, I keep a note by, because we talk books a lot. She says, no, don't put it on that list. You never read stuff I tell you off that list. That list is too long. Read it. I don't want to be on my deathbed and you trying to finish it because you promised me you'd read this book.
Uh-huh.
And we both just crack up. And I go, okay. So the last thing she says as I'm hanging up the phone, I say, I love you. And she goes, get that book. So I looked at the library website and they had like 30 people waiting for it.
Oh, wow.
And so I went to Kindle where it's on sale. In fact, I think it's just always $1.99. So,
oh, my goodness. Yeah.
I think I have not seen that price ever go up. And so I got it and I started reading it, and I read it in 2 days, and I called her and I said, listen, halfway through this book, I was realizing I would be reading it at your deathbed and telling you you can't die because I'm almost done with it and I want to talk about it. I love this book. And in fact, it's going to be living on my Kindle for a long time.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Well, I'm definitely going to pick up the audio version so I can listen mm-hmm. to that. So mm-hmm. just throw it in the car or something.
I might be going triple book here. I might have to, when it comes out in paperback, I might have to actually have an actual print edition.
Uh-huh.
Since I like print better than the Kindle.
Very cool.
It works on the Kindle, but I'm just saying.
I got a new Kindle for my birthday, which was a few weeks ago. And one of the really cool things about it, and Tamahomi told me about this before I even got it.
Oh, thank goodness we mentioned him.
Yes. Tam has improved my life in many ways. But it tells you how many minutes you have until the end of the book. And I find that really helpful. It's like, oh, you know, I can be done with this in another hour. I'll go ahead and do it, you know, finish it. So it knows how fast you read by, you know, it probably tells the NSA that information.
I think Don would love that book.
Don would love that too.
Kind of creeps me out. I might like it actually. I'm like, I'm always bothered. I'm not bothered actually, but when I look at something and go, 49%, huh? And it's not that I don't flip through a book, you know, kind of look at a book and go home about halfway through. I don't know why.
Uh-huh.
I have a love-hate relationship with the Kindle.
Yeah.
It's my own little bit of irrational rosiness coming out.
But I like it. I like the Kindle.
You said it's backlit. And
it's backlit. Yeah, it's a paper white is what they call it. Mm-hmm. It's a small one. It's like 6 inches.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's really nice.
Oh, that's nice.
Thumbs up. Yeah, my previous Kindle was not backlit. You had to have a little light, and it was sometimes, you know, not perfect. But this mm-hmm. one is just right. They really nailed it.
Oh, good.
And it works really well.
Oh, good.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I do recommend spending the extra $20 to get the not ad version. There's no ads on it. It's funny that they do it that way, but it's like,
I know.
Oh, $119 for ads or $139 for no ads. And I definitely got the no ads one.
I would always do that. Yeah, Rose got one about a year ago when she got permanently hired at her job. And she went, I splurged. Now I have a guaranteed income. And so she got the no ads one.
Uh-huh.
I was like, yeah, $20 is a small price to pay, yeah. I would think.
Yeah, it's just funny that they would, you'd think that they'd give it away for even less than that for those ads. You know, $50.
But surely they make more than that off the ads, $20.
Surely they do. Surely they do. Yeah.
Of course, I like Amazon. I hear people complaining about them, you know, being a sprawling giant, but I admire Jeff Bezos, is that uh-huh. how you say his name?
Yep.
His, just his ways of trying things. Let's poke out here and try this. Let's try that. Let's do Amazon Prime and see how that works. Well, let's throw in some extra value for it. Let's, you know, uh-huh. let's see what works.
That's
and
cool.
I kind of feel like I get extra value.
Oh, do you? That's good. Yeah, well, I haven't tried Amazon Prime.
Yeah, because I don't, you know, do Netflix or anything. We just have an antenna and we rent DVDs because there's a neighborhood place that I would rather keep in business than Netflix. But, but you know, you can stream video.
Yeah.
They have free things on there that you can stream, TV shows, or that's why we watched Mud. Tom was looking through the new movies and went, hey, this is not some old thing. This is relatively new.
Huh, cool.
Matthew McConaughey. And he, you know, he did get his shirt off a couple times. So it was not the typical role for him at all.
Oh, okay.
It was kind of an amazing movie in a way.
Nice. Mud, okay.
Recommended.
Cool. Thumbs up. Well, all right. What have we got coming up here? So I mentioned next week. Yeah, next week is Jesus, A Pilgrimage by James Martin.
Mm-hmm.
Terrific. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
And then after that, a couple of weeks after that, is I Confess, one of Alfred Hitchcock's early movies.
Lesser known.
Lesser known, yeah. Excited about that one.
I know. As a matter of fact, the assisted living group that I do a movie group with, somebody had that on their movie, you know, said had asked for that.
Oh,
and I went, hey, two birds, one stone.
All right.
So I was like looking up some information on it, not... I had to stop because it was getting too spoilerish, but I was like, oh, we're going to have plenty to talk about.
You bet. You bet. Well,
Catholic priest, seal of the confessional, etc.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And then after that is The Source by James Michener.
Mm-hmm.
So good deal.
Yes.
Another big
book. Well, you're really into the Holy Land lately. That's about going the history of the Holy Land. And then you have, James Martin first going there.
Yeah.
I like the virtual traveling.
Yeah, me too. It's good stuff. Well, all right.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see everybody in a couple of weeks, I guess. Actually, 1 week. 1 week, yeah.
Oh,
this one was messed up. This one's a little late because I was at work.
Yeah. Well, but so you get this book. It's a light, easy read. It's a perfect summer read. Uh-huh. And then you get ready for vacation, which we're all going to the Holy Land together.
You bet. I love it. Good deal.
Well, have a good week then.
All right, yes. Everyone have a good week. And I'll talk to you next week.
Yes.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.